sworn, and Annette can tell us that we're properly noticed.
Yes, we are.
And let's stand, and maybe prior to the Pledge of Allegiance, let's take a moment of silence to honor the victims of our Mandalay Bay shooting last week. Thank you. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Right then. So first item would be a allowance of public comment. Anybody wishing to speak on anything that's on the agenda is welcome to do so. And appears nobody is interested in that, so we'll move on. Next would be an adoption of the agenda, and I would take a motion for adoption.
So move.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
And the agenda is on. So first item there is next consent agenda item, and that would be the minutes from our July 10 meeting. I have had a chance to look, and they do look like a proper reflection of what that meeting was. Anybody have any comments?
I didn't see it. I say fine.
All right. I believe we have a motion for approval. We have a second.
I'll second.
All in favor of approving the minutes, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None are opposed. Next item is a report discussion action. Discuss and approve the Southern Nevada District Board of Health nominations of officers. And I believe a request for nominations had gone out. Maybe Michelle can kind of refresh us as to where that process has been. And we have not yet actually had a board action to select officers. Does that sound right? Today would be that selection.
This board has not, although you can see the names that the regular Board of Health nominated. The nominations committee met and I believe nominated other folks. Excuse me. Nominations for chair included Tina, Tim and Dr. Osgood, and for vice chair, those two and Michael Collins, and the same two, I'm sorry, Tina and Dr. Osgood and Michael Collins, and the board came back with their recommendation to you of the chair being Dr. Osgood and the vice chair being Michael Collins. So you can either act on those or come up with your own recommendations that would then go back to the regular Board of Health for its regular meeting in 2 weeks.
So the regular Board of Health will ultimately approve the recommendation?
Yes. No?
These have actually already been approved, but if you all want, if for whatever reason, if this doesn't meet with your needs, or if you think there needs to be a variation, then that would be your recommendation to the full board, and that's what we would take back to the board at the full board meeting in 2 weeks.
Who has the authority to select?
The board does.
The regular board.
Regular board.
The regular board does.
I've got a comment. I was never approached and at all whether I wanted to be chair of this. Nobody ever talked to me, and I cannot make any Thursday meeting anymore. So if there's ever a time that somebody representing this group has to be part of the, has to make a presentation on Thursday, I can't do it. And I respectfully would withdraw my name so that somebody who could make a Thursday meeting could be chair of this committee so they could be, so it could be consistent.
So you're saying that you would like to withdraw on the grounds that should this committee need to be represented by its chair, you
right.
won't be able to make the the regular Thursday meeting.
Correct.
I respect that.
Yeah. And I suggest that Tim continue. I think he's done a wonderful job. But that's what I would like to withdraw from that. Unless you think, yeah, that...
No, we can certainly take that back to the board. Okay. I would suggest, though, that when we go back to the board with modifications to the nominations that they've selected, that you have something in its place. So I would suggest that you all have a discussion now about the chair and vice chair as they've been identified by the full board, and either accept, reject, and modify.
And
that would be part of your recommendation to the full board.
And to recommend your own.
Right.
In place of, for example, you, Dr. Osgood.
Yeah, well, I recommended that Tim continue as the chair.
I concur.
Well, I would say I am happy to continue in that role. If others would like the experience of that role, I'm certainly not adamant that I got to stay here on that role.
Second. Well, I think attendance is important as well. And you definitely showed that. I have no complaints with you remaining the chair. So
may I ask Dr. Osgood if you are making a motion to recommend that Mr. Jones be the chair, and Ms. Coker, you are seconding that motion. Those aren't the words you use, but I think that's
I'll accept
the intent.
Those words. Yes, that's the intent.
And okay. You are formally withdrawing.
Correct.
And so you have just said that you're happy with that. Are there any other comments from any members of this board?
I'm happy as well, being a newer member. The 2 months of experience I have had here, I'm happy with it.
So may I ask, Mr. Chair, are there any other nominations from this board for chair? I don't hear any, but I think we should ask.
I agree, and if anybody else would like to serve in that role, please say so. And I'll assume Michael is willing and able and interested in being vice chair.
Yeah.
Or would you like to be chair? And
no.
Consider yourself voluntold.
Yeah. No. I've taken a different position at the hospital, so I'll be available on any of the weekdays to serve however the board needs me.
I am curious, Michael, were you notified of this recommendation by the board?
No.
I think that's interesting.
Well, that's probably our fault then for not so notifying you. And I apologize for that. We probably should have done that. I know that we have your nominations, yours included, for other folks, and we should have gotten back to you with these nominations. But given that, if we can act on what we can today, then I would appreciate it. And Mr. Chair, do you want to act on each individual person, the chair and the vice chair, separately or together?
I would recommend we take them together and just have an acclamation vote if we can.
So may I ask if you're changing your motion to include Mr. Collins as the vice chair?
Yes, I am.
And are you? Okay, so we've got a friendly amendment. Mm-hmm. Am I doing everything right?
You're fine.
So then someone can call the question.
I'll call the question.
All right, any further discussion? All in favor of myself, Tim Jones, serving as chair, and Michael Collins serving as vice chair, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None are opposed, and there are our officers.
So we will take these back to the Board of Health and get back to you immediately afterwards, assuming that they will accept these, and I assume they will. But if they don't, then we'll get back to you on a corporate basis. Remind me when we send out a message to all of you, just respond to me. Don't respond to all,
okay.
Because that looks like we're discussing potential motions outside of the board process.
Is there a term limits or something like that?
I think it's every year.
But I mean, can Mr. Jones?
Oh, I don't believe there's a term limit for this. And do we know what the term, because this is a new board,
right.
This is the first vote afterwards. So let us look at.
I don't know if you're maxed out or not. Just take a look.
Can't be. It's two terms for the regular board, and that's 1 year each for those terms. And this is the first. You've only been nominated the one time that
I think
this.
We are serving for 2 years on this.
For
board.
2 years, and this is
okay.
Your the four.
We're ending
year.
Our first year.
Right. This is your first full year. Board, you came down to the advisory.
That's correct.
Right.
Okay, so we'll get back to you on the niceties and the specifics of that.
All right, then. Move on to item two, which is discuss the 2018 board meeting schedule. And we've been meeting on a quarterly basis. We can have some discussion if anybody sees any reason to change that. And then,
I'll do it at the CHO meeting, yeah.
Maybe select some dates, or we want to continue with the same kind of date schedule we had and just plug in the days of the calendar for 2018?
I think we're recommending that you stay where you are unless you all want to change. This seems to be working well for you and for mm-hmm. us and for the regular board. So if I don't know that you need to make a motion on that, but you can't. Our legal counsel says that you do, so the motion
I move that we meet consistent with what we've done in the past.
And maybe Michelle can tell us what those dates would be in 2018 that match what dates we selected here in 2017.
The board meets the second Monday of the designated month on a quarterly basis, and those dates are January 8th, April 9th, July 9th, and October 8th.
One more time for slow guys like me. April what?
January 8th, April 9th, July 9th, and October 8th.
Okay.
So those would be our recommendations, and that's your motion. Then I'm turning it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Any for a comments second. Or discussion on that? Take a motion to accept those meeting dates for 2018.
Dr. Osgood so made that motion.
And we'll take a second.
Second.
All in favor of those meeting dates, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. So we move on.
We will send out a reminder. Michelle will send out a reminder with all those dates to put it so it'll automatically be on your calendar.
All right, and the next item is an update on accreditation.
We have Emily here.
Good morning, everyone. Oh, are we on?
You're on.
Okay.
I believe.
Testing.
Ah, there we go. Okay. For 1 minute.
So we have changed our software program from regular Office to Office 365. And so at least I will be clumsy doing this for the foreseeable future. Emily doesn't seem to be. But that's why things look a little bit different to you, perhaps.
All right. Good morning, Board. I am the Acting Accreditation Coordinator. I'm new to this role. I took it over in July. So if you guys got your presentation last time from Michelle, I'm the new coordinator. So, all right. So part of this is going to be a repeat of Michelle's presentation from the last meeting, but I know we have some new board members. So accreditation is set by the Public Health Accreditation Board, and there are 12 standards that they require that each health district pursuing accreditation demonstrate. And it's designed to flow with the 10 public health essential services. Those are 1 through 10. And then we have domain 11, which is administration, and domain 12, which is governance. That essentially is this board right here. There are several steps in the accreditation process. That's preparation, registration, and application. Our application has been submitted. What that means is that we have a 12-month period from our application to have all of our documentation ready to submit to FAB. And once that happens, that'll be in February. Then we'll have a small delay while they select the team that will come into our site visit. They will then give us their accreditation decision if we are approved or we're put on a temporary plan. So if there are areas where we're not fully demonstrating that we meet the measure, they will give us a time to go back and reselect documents that give us that satisfaction for that measure. There are annual reports once we are accredited that we will submit to FAB. And after 5 years, we have to apply for reaccreditation. Okay, so this is kind of where accreditation stands at the moment. We have 9 staff members that are currently working on accreditation. That does go up and down a little bit as workflow in the district permits. Sometimes we'll have more, sometimes we'll have less. And this is only the employees that are working under our accreditation code. To give our employees a little bit better of a tracking, we created a special billing code. The funds are the same, but that is the employees that are billing directly to that code. For the month of September, we have 168 employee hours that have been invested in accreditation. So this is a pretty substantial measure across the district. Okay, so we have had a lot of successes. We've got lots of employee participation across the district, which is important for us, that our employees understand what accreditation is. We are essentially demonstrating how we do things and how we can learn better what things that we can do to meet nationwide standards for public health. As you can see, we do have some areas that are still being developed. We've got some policies in process that are going through our policy committee. We are working pretty heavily on our quality improvement process. What that is it decides, it delineates what processes we want to improve through quality improvement and gives us a A to Z timeline and measure for us to document what quality improvement projects we're working on. Then we also have performance management that flows in with our quality improvement project. So those are the three big areas that we're working on right now. Okay, so this is just a quick rundown of all of our people that are currently working. As you can see, there's much more than nine employees, but we have reviewers who are looking at all of our documentation. We have the quality improvement team, and then we have document submitters. So the submitters are people who are going and pulling documentation from the various divisions in the district. Our document reviewers are subject matter experts for some of our domains. Others are just a second or a third eyeball across our documentation to make sure it's relevant and it meets all the requirements. Okay, so this is our lovely little Excel file. And I apologize, it's kind of small, but I wanted to get all of the colors in there. Green and blue are the best colors. That means those documents have been submitted. They've been reviewed by at least one or two people. And there's a couple of areas that are still blank. Those are our performance measures, the policies that we're developing. Most of those blank spots have documents that we are thinking about or we are still looking for. So there's very few areas that we are still behind on. The main one being domain 9, and that's our performance management and quality improvement. That's why we're working on that domain pretty heavily right now. So this is our document status. So we have 336 documents that are required in total. We have 226 out of those 336 documents ready to go. Those are reviewed and we could submit those today. We have another 182 documents that are ready for review, which means that those document reviewers will actually get to those documents and annotate them, highlight them, make sure that they fully demonstrate what FAB is looking for. We have 121 documents that have been reviewed by one person. We try to get two or three document reviewers just so that we have specialists from inside that department as well as outside, so that sometimes when you're looking at something, you see what you expect to see, but it's helpful to have a second or a third eye. We've got 10% of our documents that we know have issues that we're currently working on addressing. And then you see we've got 19% of our documents which have been reviewed by multiple reviewers and are ready to go.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
So you have five reviewers and you have 182 that still, is that significant to get quality reviewing done?
We have document reviewers that come and go. So those five reviewers are essentially our full-time document reviewers. When we need assistance from other departments, we will actually go to those departments and ask, or we will submit a general request for additional eyes. So it does seem like we have a lot of documents that haven't been reviewed, but we will, as we need to, as we get closer to our timeline, we will actually put out a request, and we have had no issues getting volunteers to review those documents when we need them.
All right, thank you.
Are any of these documents dated such that they're going to become old documents prior to submission that it's going to require a repeat?
Actually, when we submit the documentation into our folders, that's one of the things we keep in mind. FAB has their timeline, so most of these documents are within 5 years. Some of them are within 2 years. We have a couple that are within 12 months. So that has to be within our, it goes by our submission date. So if we're going to submit in February 2018, those documents will have to be within that 5 year window going back to 2013 or 2016 or 2017, depending on the actual, the measure itself. Does that sort of answer that question?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, sorry, I know I'm throwing a lot of information at you. The slide sheet or the spreadsheet is available for review if anybody does want to see it. Okay, so this is kind of a real quick review of what we are currently focusing on. As I mentioned before, Domain 9 is performance management and quality improvement. We are creating this from scratch. This does not exist here at the district at this moment, so that's why this is taking a considerable amount of effort on our part. If any of our board members who are from not public health sector want to actually give us suggestions, if you've ever done quality improvement or performance management, we are actively seeking input from the board as to that process. Domain 11 is our administrative and management capacity. We are working on district-wide policy that is being revamped for simplicity and clarity. Essentially, we have some old policies that are still in effect, but we are bringing them up to current standards and numbering them as such, so that everybody has access to the same policies in one location. Policies on health equity and IT data protection are being developed. And then lastly, we're waiting for some financial data, some audit data that'll be available at the end of October, so that we're submitting all of our current financials. All right, so domains 2 and 5, as you can see from our original spreadsheet, they have some gaps in documentation, but they are being addressed. What that means is we have an idea of what we're submitting into those blank spaces. And then lastly, domain 12, this domain emphasizes the relationship between the Board of Health, the Public Health Advisory Board, and the SNHD management staff. We do have some gaps. We are currently seeking that documentation. Okay, so now that I've thrown all of that information at you, does anybody else have any questions?
Just a comment. Having been through this, there's a lot of stuff that has been prepared in other industries. Are you able to access some of that, such as the GE's quality improvement stuff? They made that public.
Yes, we actually are part of the Public Health Performance Improvement Network. Myself and a number of other members working on the project have access to that listserv. And that actually is a really great resource for us, because a lot of the other public health departments that have been through accreditation will make examples of their documents available for specific domains, which does help us. In fact, our health equity policy is kind of a collection from other similar situated health departments. So yes, we are definitely making use of whatever resources we can. Yes, exactly.
And as a point of information, Adele left about 4 months ago, I believe, as the accreditation coordinator. Michelle then acted ably in her absence for a month or two, and then Emily has now stepped in, and she'll be there for the duration of accreditation, but we're now changing the title, as we need to rehire into a quality assurance kind of a person, because at the end of this, we will be accredited. And so therefore, it's now time to transition into a quality assurance.
Quality improvement performance management manager.
Right, who will also keep this as part of his or her table of contents going forward.
You guys have done an amazing job so far.
Thank you. I'm building on the shoulders of the people who've gone before me, so thank you very much.
And currently, by the way, I think only Carson City Health and Human Services is accredited. Washoe County isn't, the state isn't, and we aren't. Go ahead, sir.
So we expect February 18th to be the completion of all materials for submission?
That is actually our deadline to submit all of our documents to FAB via their online portal. We actually are hoping to have as much done before everybody goes on vacation for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So we are looking actually at mid-November to try and have as much done as possible.
And what might be a wild guess projection as to when a result might come back?
It takes approximately 6 months from our submission until the site visit. That does vary a little bit, but generally they pick site reviewers that are from different, they're actually generally members of other health districts that volunteer as site visitors. And so they'll come and spend 2 days here at the district reviewing our documentation, reviewing our processes, actually talking to our people to verify that everything we've given to the public health administration is what we're actually using. So after the site visit is completed, it varies. It depends on how long the site reviewers take to review all of our documentation. It can be a couple of months. We were told when we were in training that it can be 3 to 4 months. So we probably won't know until about this time next year whether we actually have been accredited or not.
I know this may be premature, but do you think we'll be ready for that site visit?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I can't stress enough how helpful the employees here are. All of the documentation that's been submitted by our teams is their specialty. So the employees have pulled things that they know, and so when the site visitors come and they ask questions about it, those employees will be crucial because they'll be able to demonstrate that working knowledge of those documents. So I absolutely think we're going to be ready.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next well, up. I do have one. So if we're responsible for this report, I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Are we going to review this report before it's submitted? Because I'd like to. If we're responsible for this report,
you mean for the accreditation documents?
Mm-hmm. Or for the what you're going to submit?
You're asking if this board is responsible for it?
No, you're
oh,
not.
Oh, I thought I misunderstood her. I thought this board was responsible for this particular report.
We're an integrated part of the process of what's the organizational structure that
but
they
not
submit.
The approval
but not
okay.
The approval
part. It's all basically internal kinds of issues that we have to prove to the board that we're to the Public Health Accreditation Board that we're ready to go forward for accreditation site review.
And so now, what exactly is our role?
I think that part of your role is that you will be probably interviewed by the accreditation board as well some members of the regular board, and so we always bring you these updates to keep you updated as to where we are. So the next one will be in January, and by that time everything should be up to date. Remember, we have invited you all to all of our internal meetings and external meetings, and so you're still welcome to do that. And I would recommend that that you do come to some of these meetings. And I'll ask Emily to make sure that you're invited, but again, don't respond to all. Just say, yes, I'll be there, or no, I won't, so that you can get as great an understanding as you can.
Okay. And I'll make sure my contact details are available to each one of you. So if you have any further questions, then I'm more than happy to answer them. If we do have documentation that you would like to review on a one-off basis, I'm more than happy to provide that as well.
Well, then my suggestion is that if we're going to be expected to participate in the survey process, that January 8th meeting on the agenda, you give us some talking points.
Absolutely.
We will.
Okay. I can do that.
It's a great idea. Thank you.
I just to review, I've attended many of those meetings that you've invited me to, and you've got a talented group of people.
Yeah,
I would agree.
And I believe, Mr. McDowell, you've been to some of those meetings as well.
Yes, I have. A few, not many.
Yeah.
I've been to a few.
And Dr.
I have
Oz,
two. I have two.
You have two. I don't remember if you're completely retired, but that's helpful if you need the time to be able to do things.
I'm not completely retired.
Okay, well, you know, I made a mistake there, but that's helpful. And Mr. Jones,
that's
I think
right.
you're still working, but you've been to some of these meetings too, because I've seen you in the back of the audience.
I am fully retired for the most part, so.
Yeah.
But I have been to a number of the meetings. None, I would say, in the last 6 or 9 months, but I have attended.
So we do invite all of you to attend any of them and all of them if you would like, as long as probably no more than 4 of you come,
mm-hmm.
So you're not a quorum. Or if you do come, that you sit far enough apart that it's clearly for information purposes only on your part and not as part of a board action.
Well, we have asked for those meetings, members do select one of the 4 pillars, and maybe you could repeat what they are just so the new board members are.
I apologize, the 4 pillars of?
Had 4 focus areas for
oh, okay, absolutely. We did have, we actually had 3. We had the access to care, we had policy and funding, and chronic disease. That's actually part of our community health assessment and our community health improvement program. We are actually looking to essentially close out the very first CHIP that we completed, and I'm putting together a success stories presentation that will actually demonstrate what we accomplished in that process and what we've learned, and we're actually going to be launching our next community health assessment and community health improvement program. We are in planning process of our steering committee. Once we have a steering committee put together, then we will actually go forward with community involvement. So that's looking probably February or March of next year.
And that is, we're doing the CHA-CHIP process that Emily just suggested on a 3-year, even though we don't have to, we can do it on a 5-year to match accreditation. But for Dignity, who is our big partner on this, they have to do it every 3 years under Medicaid, CMS regulations, IRS regulations. And so we're trying to match up with them so that what we do and what they do, we do together and meets both goals. Accreditation and their accreditation.
All right, any final comment? Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll go on to item number 5, which is number 4, and some presentation on opioid abuse and prevention efforts.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning.
We're okay? Okay. Let me just pull up my presentation really quick. Good morning. My name is Jessica Johnson. I work in the Office of Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion here at the Health District. I'm really honored to be here this morning to share with you about the efforts that we've been undertaking to address the opioid epidemic. I could probably talk on this for the better part of 30 minutes, 40 minutes, but in the interest of time, I'm going to rely a little bit on my notes so that we can get through this expeditiously. So just a quick overview, some background, our current work at SNHD, some of the challenges, and then some next steps for the community. I like to start all of these presentations with just a quick background. What we know now is that nearly 500,000 people have died from drug overdoses from 2000 to 2015, the majority of which involved opioids. This is nationally, and drug overdoses are now the leading cause of death for Americans under the age of 50. Even with recent declines in the amount of opioids prescribed per person, there was still 3 times higher prescribed opiates in 2015 than in 1999 without a marked increase in pain. We also know this is widely inconsistent across the United States. I have just a few snapshots here. These data points correspond to the state of Nevada. So in 2015, we had 82 pain prescriptions per 100 Nevadans. We knew that every 1.25 hours, a person in Nevada visited the ER with an opioid-related diagnosis. That was every hour when they were admitted to the hospital. And our current overdose death rate is 18.4 overdose deaths per 100,000 Nevadans. To bring this home, we can look a little closer here in Clark County. We know that more Clark County residents have died from opioid-related overdoses than firearms and motor vehicle traffic fatalities. The burden in Clark County for opioid overdoses deaths is highest among our 45 to 54-year-olds compared with all other age groups. However, we do know that across all age groups are higher than the national average. We also know that non-Hispanic whites have the highest death rate from opioid poisonings, followed by non-Hispanic Native Americans and non-Hispanic blacks. So just a brief snapshot of the data in our community here. The California Public Health Officer Karen Smith has referred to this as the quote-unquote perfect public health problem. And I have to agree in the sense that the public health approach to really addressing this comprehensively as a community and coming together, creating an upstream convening role with surveillance, policy systems level change, practitioner guidance, it's really going to take multiple factors and multiple community members and organizations to really make a difference. So I do think that the role of public health and the approach that we can bring to the table is vital. I'll share with you a little bit about how that's being implemented so far. So presently, myself and the executive director for a prevention coalition chair the Southern Nevada Opioid Advisory Council. It was informally formed last November after having an opportunity to attend the 2016 Governor Summit. together with governmental agencies, community groups, healthcare providers, and many, many others, law enforcement in particular. We work to develop systems-level response to the opioid crisis through evidence-based strategies and looking at unique community collaborations. Presently, we maintain a list of over 200 community members, and we meet quarterly. Our next meeting is on Halloween here, if anyone is interested in being in attendance to see what this group looks like. We really seek these systems-level solutions in finding opportunities to be unique, to have collaborations across sectors, to really move forward. There's some great things happening in our law enforcement community with some law enforcement assisted diversion and some forward steps in our emergency systems to address what happens when someone comes into the emergency room having experienced an overdose and lived through it, what we might be able to do as a community to respond. Additionally, SNHD has played a role in surveillance, conducting opioid-related surveillance and reporting on epidemiological findings for Clark County. We monitor fatality rates. We identify high-risk populations. There's some great work happening in looking at real-time surveillance methodologies through our Office of Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance. We work on translating findings and reports and evaluations for our community. What we know is that data are great, but data in a vacuum don't really have a lot of action. So we're able to bring, with some of the support from our Office of Epidemiology, this information to the table, to the community, and say, what does this look like here, and how do we want to address this? Additionally, we've been able to work with the Office of Informatics, and they've been working with the state to collaborate and look at an opioid dashboard that looks at our prescription drug data, ER, hospitalization, and fatality data, both across the state and then within our county. So you're able now to look at trends by zip code and with mapping and many more technologies that I think will be will vastly improve our community's ability to take this data and create action. Further, we had a small amount of funding to work with the PACT Coalition, and we ran some targeted media campaigns towards the end of August and throughout September. That was intentional to coincide with International Overdose Awareness Day, which was on the 31st, and September, which is when folks celebrate Recovery Month. So this is a billboard up the, sorry, the image that's up on the slide is one of our billboards that ran. We really sought to bring to the forefront that we know that opioid addiction and substance use disorder can really happen to anybody, that it doesn't discriminate. And that was something that our education subcommittee brought to the table and said, we want to know that this can happen to anyone, and where can they seek some resources? We partnered with the Philadelphia Department of Public Health for our television spots, and then our radio, mobile desktop banners, billboards, and I think we ended up running some taxi ads as well, were throughout the community from August 28th to September 30th. We also developed an opioid education webpage on our GetHealthyClarkCounty.org site under the Be Safe tab, so individuals in our community had a one-stop resource to begin to find these items.
To find the resources?
To find resources, correct. So either national, state, some local ones as well.
And there's some in Clark County?
Correct. Additionally, on July 7th, a letter was issued to primary care providers and prescribers throughout Southern Nevada, working based on a letter that was sent out from the California Department of Public Health. I had an opportunity to work with Dr. Iser and Dr. Johnson and many community partners in medicine, substance abuse prevention, treatment, and recovery to help develop this letter and its attached comprehensive list of resources. It's actionable guidance and resources for our prescribers here in Southern Nevada, really drawing together a lot of more disparate sites into one location. If anyone is interested in reviewing this letter and or its subsequent resources, I'd be more than happy to send that over to you after today.
Is that something you can get to the entire board?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank
you. You sent it out more than once.
Hopefully it's come across your desk a couple of times.
Yes.
So do the primary care physicians get it? Because they're really struggling with this.
Correct. It was disseminated through our HON, our health
Alert Network.
Alert Network. Thanks. I always forget what the A stands for.
I am getting, what's the right word? My wife used the word accosted.
Oh, okay.
With information almost, weekly is, it's more than weekly.
Okay.
From the AMA, Nevada State Medical Society, Clark County Medical Society. I'm licensed in three states. I'm getting it from the equivalents in New Mexico and the equivalents in California.
About
I'd say it's almost daily.
About the importance, but I'm worried about the resources.
No, resources.
Okay. And resources.
Resources.
Training, I imagine, as well.
And training and all of the additional steps I have to go through to keep, maintain my license.
Mm-hmm.
And if I may, there's now a requirement for physicians for 2 hours every 4 years, I believe, that the state is requiring of all physicians. And the NSMA, or I think it was the NSMA, Nevada State Medical Association, did those 2 hours for those of us in attendance at the last meeting. Did by that, I mean, they provided the education that's required. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Dr. Osgood.
That's all right. We both receive this stuff.
I know, we get the same thing, and I'm licensed in California, too.
And they're not consistent. So New Mexico requires 5. Nevada requires 2.
It
California, I forget what.
I think none so far,
California,
but I'm not sure.
California is none. So you can imagine what's going through my mind. Okay, I haven't ordered an opioid in probably 20 years. And here I'm a primary care physician and have all of these hoops to go through now.
Mm-hmm.
And
pathologists and radiologists who don't prescribe any of these things. It's a generic requirement for licensure.
I'm prejudiced to public health, as you guys know. And to me, the most constructive work has been the equivalence works of what you guys do and what's done in other health districts.
Right.
Because this is a population based problem, absolutely, not an individual problem initially.
And so again, Jessica, you'll probably refer to this, but what we do here in Clark County may or may not be promulgated throughout the state, but this letter we sent to my counterparts at the state, Carson City and Washoe County, and I believe at least Washoe County sent it out too. They always ask if they can copy our letter, making it local, and we always do. So we try to stay on the forefront of things here. It's Southern Nevada Health District. Sorry to interrupt.
My sense is that the long-term solution is going to come from the rapid responders, the people who catch them when they get to the ERs and things like that, and network these people to be able to help
the
people.
We'll talk a little bit more about this at the end.
And that's what you guys have been doing, I thought, very successfully. You've moved in that direction very nicely.
Absolutely. Thank you. Just a few more slides here, and then happy to continue this wonderful discussion. I would be remiss if I didn't mention my colleagues from Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance who work on a lot of great projects around harm reduction. There are a few that are highlighted up here, including their day-long training on harm reduction that's been really popular, to look at stigma reduction, overdose prevention, and disease of drug-related concerns such as HIV and hepatitis C. So how we approach opioid prevention with the disease prevention in mind. They also facilitate the Southern Nevada Harm Reduction Alliance, which is a group that looks to reducing drug-related stigma. They are also involved in some monthly outreach across the valley, particularly with individuals experiencing homelessness in our community.
Can you tell us what the PWID is?
PWID stands for Persons Who Inject Drugs.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
Hope.
As I'm sure you can imagine, there are challenges as we work on this, so lots of moving parts with many different agencies and policies, procedures, et cetera. I think what makes this great is that we have a steering committee of smaller folks from that Opioid Advisory Council that meet monthly to really talk about opportunities for collaboration, where progress is, what presentations are happening, who can attend, so that we can really show that collaborative support. That lack of real-time data on overdose deaths, as Dr. Osgood mentioned, is is definitely, it's a national problem. It's not one that's unique here to Clark County. So we've been looking at collaborations with the health district, the Fusion Center, and other area groups to look at more real-time syndromic surveillance data, including our law enforcement partners, and how we can be have better reaction to what's actually happening in our community here in 2017. Oh, the coroner's office is also involved in that. We have, you know, barriers to implementing medication-assisted treatment. I actually had the opportunity to sit in on some of the SAMHSA State of Nevada focus groups that were done in July on medication-assisted treatment to look at what the barriers were, the training opportunities, et cetera. And they were able to actually take that data back to the state, and the funding that's coming out right now on opioid the state grant that we received from that the state received from HHS, they actually changed the way that they administered it based on the feedback of that focus group and what some of the barriers were to help address them a little bit more comprehensively. And then finally, with many different types of communities involved in this topic, everyone has a certain perspective on this issue. So, for example, we have this Opioid Advisory Council that looks at these larger system conversations, and the Harm Reduction Alliance, which really involves the community. So in order to so our advisory council has a very strong law enforcement presence, and the Harm Reduction Alliance really wanted those individuals, maybe perhaps people who are currently in active addiction, attending their meetings and helping them get feedback about how they outreach with that community. So we have two separate meetings to honor that, and really have those populations feel comfortable, feel like they can share with where they're at, and move forward together. So the good news is, just like here, there's growing recognition of this problem via email or wherever else, and everyone's really working together to look towards solutions. This is my contact information. Should anyone be interested, I know you have the wordy version on your iPads this morning of some of these updates. But we'd be glad to share with you anything else. So thank you. I'm available for questions.
Could you please, since we don't have printed copies, could you please either email it to us or something?
Absolutely.
We will. So if I can add a few other things.
Absolutely, Dr. Iser.
You may know that we got the grant to purchase two of the exchange machines for needle exchanges, and those are at Track B now.
Correct.
And the goal is multifold. To have those is certainly to exchange dirty for clean needles, to do the harm reduction piece. It's to bring people in so that we can try to access them for treatment when and if they're ready. So I think you remember that. We also got a grant, and I can't remember who it was from, but John Hammond, who runs our program for EMS and trauma systems for Narcan, and he'll be running that out soon. Mike, do you have anything more to say about that, or is that enough?
Just quickly, the Mike Johnson, Director of Community Health. The grant that John Hammond and EMS Trauma Systems received was from SAMHSA, Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration, for 4 years for $2 million to provide training to tribal leaders and local and law enforcement on the administration of Narcan for opioid overdoses, nasal Narcan. So it's a big training grant. It'll involve EMS folks, of course, law enforcement, tribal leaders, as I mentioned, as far as the target audience, there's a big piece that fits into our office of epidemiology and disease surveillance as well. So excited to have that piece in here.
You sent us information on that.
I believe so. I think
we did.
Our pharmacy is also getting involved in that.
Yes,
too.
Our pharmacy is also
getting involved. These.
Dr. Blee, he'll be giving a presentation, but he can speak to that as well.
Okay.
So, Jessica, I have a comment. Just to tell you, your efforts are not in vain, because our orthopedists on elective cases are now lowering the doses for their chronic pain patients so that by the time when they have their surgery that they don't require as much, but we'll bring them back to their regimen. And for that, I appreciate it. I think many people are getting the information out and appropriately applying your...
Wonderful. That's great to hear. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I'd like to just take the opportunity to give Jessica a big shout out. She's really engaged the community, and I've received multiple emails and phone calls from different members of the PAC Coalition, Harm Reduction, different groups that she mentioned, acknowledging her efforts and her professionalism and her energy in engaging these various committees that she's on. So she's a gem.
Thank you, Thanks. Dr. Johnson.
I just want to make a comment about this community. This effort with the CHIP and the whole concept of getting people out of their silos and talking to each other, mm-hmm. we've done this before. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Three Square, the food bank.
Sure.
That was created using the same model. We used to have dozens and dozens of silos of charity groups, both religious and non-religious, that were collecting food and not getting it distributed to the people in this county who were in need. And the Hilton group put together a similar CHIP and created what became the Three Square, which was a consolidation of getting people out of the silos. We have a history of success, and I'm looking forward to us having a success with this.
Thank you.
May I ask you a question? And I may have missed it, you may have said it. The slide you had up there showing all these people that are going to the emergency room every 15 minutes with a problem, and every hour if someone's being taken into the hospital. I see all the statistics, percentages, and everything, but can you tell me if the majority of all these people, these thousands of people that are dying from this, are they obtaining their opioids from legal prescriptions, or is there illegal narcotics that are causing this? Is there a percentage of how many are getting it legally from a doctor, and how many are getting it off the street from a drug dealer?
Yeah, I imagine there is. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you legal versus illegal, because we do analyze them together, since my understanding from the epidemiological standpoint is that we want to look at opioids in a large perspective. As far as all overdoses go, I believe it's about 75%, two-thirds of them are opioid-involved on some level. I would be more than happy to chat with our epidemiology folks and see if it is possible to look at legal versus illegally obtained versus illicit opioids on the street versus, synthetic, which would be fentanyl. I know we haven't seen that as much prevalent here in our community as they have out on the East Coast for anyone following opioids on that level, but I would be willing to ask if that's of interest.
The only reason I ask is because if they're getting them mostly illegally through a pharmacy and they're abusing them, then I think that a lot of this goes back to some scrutiny on the physicians that are continuing to prescribe a person all these drugs, sure. rather than on the black market, which is more of a law enforcement. They got to look at it from law enforcement, as opposed to looking at it from who's the prescribing all this, and why? Is there any scrutiny on these doctors? That's the only reason I ask this.
The dashboard that I briefly mentioned just came online, I want to say, a couple of weeks ago even. So it may be that we're able to sort of ascertain, because that does have prescription drug monitoring program data in it, a little bit more clearly what prescribing behaviors do look like. But I would be more than happy to ask.
But and the only reason I say that and brought it up here this morning is because I worked narcotics for 31 years with the FBI before I retired from the Bureau. And the majority of the people that we were arresting for selling narcotics, these pills, these heavy narcotics, they were getting them and bragging about it, that they just go to the doctor, the doctor gives them the prescription, they go out, they get them from the pharmacy, and then they sell them on the street. I mean, the problem was with the doctors.
Yeah.
From that. So that's the only reason I bring that up. I'm just curious what the percentages were.
You're absolutely right. The overwhelming majority is from a doctor, is from legitimate doctor prescription. I don't remember the numbers, even though the JAMA just a couple of weeks ago gave us the numbers, and I forget what it was.
There was a report done at NSMA, not this year, but the year before, that showed that actually the number, at least in our community or in our state, due to prescriptions is going down, whereas heroin is going up. And part of the problem is that once people are addicted, mm-hmm. and then they no longer have access to legal drugs, then they go out on the street and get illegal drugs, which could have been stolen or could be heroin or other drugs on the street. So at least that's what I recall from a year and a half ago at the NSMA meeting.
But still, the majority of the people who present to the emergency rooms and the ones that you're referring to come from, have had legal prescriptions. Uh-huh. But I don't remember what the number was.
We'll find that out and bring it back to you.
We can find that out.
I think I've still got that magazine sitting on my desk.
Yeah. So two other pieces I think are important for you. And I certainly, have any of you been watching PBS over the last 2 or 3 weeks? The News Hour on PBS? Okay. I would beg you to do that, or to go, if you can, into On Demand, because they have had almost every night something about the opioid crisis, not about Nevada, much of it about West Virginia, which is sort of the epicenter of this and other places are the epicenters outside of us. It's not an urban problem. It's probably more a rural problem in many, many, many cases in terms of the number of overdoses and the harm reduction issues. Southern Indiana, I think, is where that big HIV outbreak due to IV drug use was found. And so I would really recommend, and maybe I'll ask Jennifer, if she's not here, I'll ask Jennifer to see if she can find those resources and send them out to you. Then the other thing that I think is really important is, starting about 4 years ago, we were working with then the chairs of the Assembly Health Committee and the Senate Health Committee, Andy Eisen and Justin Jones, about regionalization of the State Department of Behavioral health piece of it. And that has been proceeding very slowly. You might recall there was a governor's meeting, he brought in someone from out of state who made some recommendations along with our two legislators, and then of course it changed over. But they're in the process of still trying to regionalize that, and I believe our region will include Nye and Esmeralda County. I would prefer that it also include Lincoln, because they're right next door to us as well. And their hospital is probably an hour's drive from our border. It's not very far. But at any rate, that regionalization will start to allow us in the various regions of Nevada to start to look at the behavioral health issues that relate to us in our counties. And I think that this will be important for us to try to find additional resources to address this problem.
Is the health district looking at tracking any, like, the heroin, the fentanyls before it does become a problem? Because as we limit the prescriptions, like, they're going to go to the black market. And I attended a conference in Vancouver, and they have a huge fentanyl issue right now. They're hit over 200 deaths just from fentanyl.
It's a dangerous drug.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If I can just add, so one of the key partners who's actually on our steering committee is Keith Carter, who's executive director for HIDA, the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area of Nevada, and he provides a lot of that data. So looking at seizures and fentanyl from that perspective, and then we do have some of our EMS colleagues as well as our law enforcement officers on that group to really keep an eye on this and to see how it is manifesting here in Southern Nevada, hopefully to get ahead of that tide.
That'd be great, because if we start seeing a spike, then maybe we can combat it before it becomes an epidemic here.
You know, we have a history of drug recycles, and we're in the cycle now.
Yeah.
Everybody who is old enough remembers what happened with the returning vets from the Vietnam. And we had another issue predating that in the early 60s.
Let's remember that veterans aren't immune now with amputations and
so
on.
That's horrible.
Not at all.
Well, I'm editorializing, but it's a very serious problem.
Great.
We've had, I've been on, I practiced medicine in a rural area of the Southwest for many, many years, and we had to discipline some of our colleagues who were overdosing patients, and we're going back years.
Thank you.
Any other comment or question? Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Next item would be to discuss and approve any recommendations to take to the District Board of Health.
And I will take the recommendations for chair and vice chair to the Board of Health.
Any other comments or any other suggestions that we need to get back to the district board, opposed to what we're doing here on the advisory board? That's it then. And so we'll go on to health officer.
Mr. Chair, in addition to the meeting schedule, needs to be shared.
We'll take that to the board.
Okay. So the recommendation for board officers as well as the meeting dates. We'll go to the district board. Okay. Then we will go on to health officer and staff.
Can I get a motion on that, please?
So move.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None are opposed. Now we will go on to the health officer reports.
So just a few things. First of all, we have had a public health associate from the CDC. This is an employee who's hired by CDC, and then they go out to either internal CDC organizations or external. Last year we got Tanya Sutton, who I think you have met, but she certainly was on that list of people for accreditation. So she has one more year with us as part of the accreditation team. And then we got three more that just started last week. One who will work with public health emergency preparedness, and she sort of got inundated this last week. One who will be working with foods, and one who will be working with Vector, and it will give them other experiences as it comes up. So you may or may not know, but since they're CDC employees, they can often be pulled for hurricane response, any of a number of things. So I think, we had an EIS officer, I believe it was, who was pulled to go to Africa on the Ebola response. So these employees can be pulled away from us, but we want to try to get them an opportunity to do some publication if they can, as well as to work and learn in the areas to which they've been assigned.
Are they paid by the district or CDC?
They're paid by the CDC. So what we pay is the mentoring time. If there's local travel, then we will pay for that. Workshops or organizations, depending, will likely pay for those as well. So what I had asked last year when we received one is for people to start working for this year, and so that made us very successful. So we have a couple of division directors behind me, and I'm going to ask them again to start looking at what can we do to apply for these folks, for additional folks for next year. It's an annual two-year assignment. We did reach an agreement with the union, and the board ratified that agreement for wages only. What that includes is a 2.5% across the board pay raise for this year and for next year, and then we're going back to a two-step increase. So for those people who aren't at the top of their pay scale, they would receive a two-step increase, approximately 5%, until they do reach the top of their pay scale. So in about a year, a little bit over a year, we'll be going back with the full agreement with the union, and so that will include all of the chapters. This chapter was chapter 20. It was on pay only, since we had come up with a five-year agreement with the union last time.
What union?
SEIU.
Okay.
So we have two chapters of it, one for frontline folks, the other one for supervisors.
5% is a lot.
I'm sorry?
I said 5% is a lot.
Well, it ends up depending, 7.5%, because they'll get the 2.5, everyone except for me gets a 2.5% this year and next year, and the people who aren't topped out will get up to two steps this year and next year as well. But some people, we do have a number of people who are already topped out, so they would not get an increase if they're topped out in their scale.
Not even a cost of living?
No, they'll get the cost of living. That's the 2.5%. That's why I've been trying to describe those in two different pots. One is cost of living for this year, everyone but me. Next year, 2.5%.
Well, why not you?
Well, that's going to be up to the board to decide if I deserve anything.
Now, when you talk about steps, are those usually 5%?
each step is usually around 2.5%.
Okay.
So that's why if they're, let's say they're step 10, they go up to a step 12, which is 5%.
Okay, okay.
But if they're a step 13, they'd only go up one step, which is 2.5%. 14 is the top of our step scale. And then, as you know, we had the multi-casualty incident that occurred just over a week ago, and either Misty or Jeff or both will give us a brief update as to what we've been doing and what the overall response has been.
Thank you very much. Can y'all hear me okay?
Yes.
Can't hear myself. My name is Misty Robinson. I'm a senior public health preparedness planner for Office of Public Health Prevention. I can't even talk today. I'm sorry. Maybe Jeff, you should do this whole
okay.
thing.
Okay. No, I won't do that. But I'm Jeff Quinn. I'm the manager of public health preparedness here at the health district, and both Misty and I, and as well as our staff and preparedness, as well as health district staff, were involved in the response. Initially the response, and now we're in recovery operations. So
I do have stuff written down, so I can't screw that up, hopefully. Clark County activated their multi-agency coordination center, as well as the medical surge area command, on Sunday night directly after the incident occurred. That was to support law enforcement efforts and medical surge operations. SNHD representatives at that time were tasked with coordinating and supporting the immediate medical surge needs, EMS transports as needed as well. And basically there were two shifts of 12 hours, and Jeff and our supervisor, Steve Kramer, and one of our trainers, Wendy Pagan, took on that initial first 12-hour overnight operational period, and then myself and Todd Nicholson took on the day shift for a few days. Monday afternoon, the governor declared a state of emergency, as well as a public health and medical emergency. That was important because it allows for us to request medical professionals from other states to come and assist. Fortunately, we didn't necessarily need that, but it was good to have that in case something else went wrong, or in case we needed to bring in some additional medical people to relieve some of the medical folks that were working that night and the next few days. Since activation, the public health focus at the Multi-Agency Coordination Center and the Medical Surge Area Command has been devoted to coordinating medical and mental health resources, working with hospitals to track patients, and requesting medical resources as needed. The most difficult task throughout this whole thing was getting the numbers from the hospitals of who they had, what their names were, what their disposition was, so that we could notify families and make sure that they received family assistance later on. A joint information center was also established, where SNHD public information representatives coordinated with other responding agencies to ensure that a consistent message was being provided to the media across the valley. On Monday afternoon, a family assistance center was established at the convention center to gather information on missing persons from family members and provide counseling and support to those looking for their loved ones. Medical Reserve Corps mental health volunteers were dispatched to the FAC to assist in providing psychological first aid as needed. Again, there actually wasn't a large number of people that went to the Family Assistance Center initially, so but at least they were available if families needed assistance. A family reunification center was also established at the convention center to reunite survivors with their family members. As the victims were all identified, the reunification center demobilized. The space is now being used to store the personal items that were left at the location, and Metro is working with the Family Assistance Center to get those folks to claim their property. And that's on a, it's kind of on a piece by piece of when, as they finish one area of their investigation, one area of the venue, they're releasing those items and they're going, I think there's about five or six different areas that they're going to grab these personal items and let people know, if, hey, if you were in Section A, you can receive your items now. Next, we'll be working on Section B, and we'll let you know when those items will be available. There is currently no need of any additional support at this time, with the exception of environmental health staff, which we've been sending out to the Family Assistance Center to make sure that the food that's being provided is safe and to make sure the solid waste issues are maintained properly. All death certificates, I believe, have been generated. We are currently compiling and aggregating information on potential mental health resources that may be needed in the next several days to weeks to months, as members of the community and first responders continue to process the event and what happened that night, and potentially seek mental health assistance. A helpline has been established at the Clark County Multi-Agency Coordination Center to field calls related to this incident, and to get them away from 211, so they're calling this 702-455-AIDE number instead. Over the weekend, there were not a lot of calls, I believe 32 Friday and 32 on Saturday. I don't know how they fared yesterday, but I would imagine it's about the same. As recovery operations continue, the Medical Search Area Command has been demobilized, and the MAC has been downgraded to level one. So basically, it's folks at their desk. If we need to ramp up again, then we've got health district staff available 24/7 to assist in that effort. Family Assistance Center will be at the Convention Center until October 12th. After that, the county is looking for additional space where they can move those services. And I don't believe that they have found that yet. Did I miss anything?
No, you covered everything. You know, I wanted to say that a lot of what my office does and the staff here at SNHD, we do a lot of training and exercises. And so really, over the past years, the federal grants that we've received and are stewards of have capabilities in there, and we try to train and exercise to those capabilities. We've done a lot with our community partners over the years, and I think really when real events do happen, muscle memory kicks into play. And from the outside, not from us internal to the MAC, you know, it's organized chaos. However, you know, after the event's over, you hear people that were watching the news see that it was a very organized, seamless response. And I think that reflects well of our community, that we've invested the time in training and exercises so that when the real events do happen, we can respond to them. We did have other, through the MAC resource request, we did have other public health department personnel down assisting with the Family Assistance Center down here for a few days for the acute portion of the response. And, you know, I think moving forward, even I got comments yesterday from the coroner's office that they really were thankful that we've invested a lot of time in mass fatality planning, or MCI, really the type of community that we live in. There are threats, there are public health threats, the large venue events we have. And so I think moving forward, people, we will continue to do the training and exercises, but I think a lot more people will be paying a little more attention than, oh, I got to go to a training, I got to do an exercise. And I think that really stands well for us.
Another thing that we're looking to do, hopefully with hospital coordination, is obtaining the disposition of the patients when they arrived at the hospital versus their diagnosis or their cause of death, so that we can get an idea of whether the majority of the patients were there because of gunshot wounds or if they were blunt force trauma with trampling or falling and hitting their heads, things like that.
So I was completely gratified by the fact that both Boston and Orlando reached out to me and sent us resources that we were able to adjust to our own needs here and go forward. They didn't even ask, they just sent it. And we have gotten notes from all over the country of support from public health departments and others giving us internal support. I can't thank enough all of the staff who responded and who have yet to respond, because we will be responding with more resources today or tomorrow, and so I can't be more grateful. In general, as you know, if it were a public health emergency, some sort of a bioterrorism attack, we would be in charge. We had a three-day exercise, I'm going to forget now, a year and a half ago?
It's been actually exactly 2 years.
Two years ago. And everyone in the county participated with us. The FBI did, Department of Homeland Security. And so even if it's a public health exercise, everyone else gets exercised as well. And even though we were the lead in that one, it's very easy, and that exercise helps us to be not a follower, but a responder to what the county and other folks wanted. So any of these exercises help all of us, and so I just want to thank the staff for all of the hours and time that they put in and will continue to put in. One of the things that Misty just referred to is that I would like to have a fairly complete idea of who was hospitalized and what, because this, I really, since Austin, there hasn't been a shooting like this that I am aware of. There have been lots of shootings, believe me. I'm not trying to underplay those, including the nightclub in Orlando, mm-hmm. who sent us information. But a shooting like this, now that it's seen as from the point of view of a terrorist or someone who's angry, as being successful, I think what we have learned will help other jurisdictions better prepare. So I want to have a sort of a toolkit that we can send out to other jurisdictions too.
One other thing I'd like to add is I'm the chair of the Southern Nevada Healthcare Preparedness Coalition. And really, even during this response, when Misty talked about the Medical Surge Area Command, really when the call went out, every hospital and healthcare system in the valley stepped up by providing either a liaison that would be in the Medical Surge Area Command, as well as coordinating with their staffs. We had our coalition meeting this last week, and it was very positive that came out. But then there were a lot of hospitals that, you know, on the periphery edge of the valley that really got the notification, got their ED staff ready to receive patients, and didn't receive quite as many there. However, it's still a good reflection upon them that they were ready to answer the call. Even though they didn't see as many patients, of the EMS transports, there were 180 ambulance transports. The thing to remember during disasters, as we've seen over and over in Colorado, Boston, the majority of patients are transported by personal vehicles. Mm-hmm. And where they're transported by personal vehicles, they're outside the system that we can monitor. So we know that, you know where the incident is, generally the hospitals closest to that incident will be the ones that will surge the greatest. And there's not an even distribution of patients across the valley. But, you know, everybody from law enforcement to emergency management to public health to the hospitals themselves really stepped up and did a fabulous job for the short time period for the medical surge. So I think it could have been much worse. And as things change, there still, we have a lot of people in critical condition and in the hospitals, and, you know, the numbers may change, as far as what the outcome of it is.
We were very fortunate that the hospitals could take on that extra surge. I'm not sure what it was about this weekend that they could do that, but typically they're at 95 to 99% capacity. And to take on the extra surge from this event was just amazing.
I just want to commend you. My wife is a psychologist, and the Nevada Psych Association emailed her I think it was Tuesday, and it might have been Wednesday, asking for volunteers for the mental health support and the family support from all of the psychologists in the state, you know, in our county. And that came, we were amazed how fast that came to us. So I just want to commend you guys. The integration was excellent.
I'd like to make a comment too. I want to commend y'all too. It was an honor to serve as a part of this. But you mentioned Misty, a group of people that I do want to point out is that first responders have gotten lots of accolades, but the last responders, the coroners, we don't want to forget them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we are actually working with John from an email that he sent me. Was it just last night?
Yes.
Or the night before?
Saturday.
Saturday. So we're working with him on other needs that he may have.
Okay.
Now we want to make sure that the first responders and coroners get the mental health services that they need, because
correct,
that is a very typically overlooked in a disaster. We need to make sure that they receive that assistance as needed.
And I would just reiterate, I think the community has increased confidence in the EMS type systems and the fact of the community coming together to support what's needed in trying to address and recover this kind of a disaster. So I think that really reflects the work that you guys have done as well in getting things prepared, and people will be more cognizant of the need and not overlook the training in the future.
Thank you.
Do you know if the blood banks are back up to
I think they're running full, and we had planned to send or allow our people to go, but there was no need over the first week. And I think, Michelle, did Jackie say the 24th is when the blood bank will be here, Verlin? So the blood bank will be here, and then we have been collecting those who want to tell us rare blood types in case the blood bank needs rare blood types for particular situations. But we will be responding to that as well.
And in terms of regulations, I know it was just recently updated regulations with the EMS system. I don't know if there would be any lessons learned that are usable for the future.
I don't believe so. I think that those regulations responded primarily to changes in state or federal law. I think this event shows that the EMS and trauma system worked and worked admirably and probably about as good as anywhere in this country could work. That would be my assessment. John Hammond will take a look at that as well, but I don't believe so. But thank you for the suggestion. We'll look into it. One last update for me, and that is that we have had a very mild vector disease season so far. I think starting early on, which frightened me, we had a death due to West Nile virus, and then we have had two additional cases of West Nile virus, and one of those has died. I don't believe we've had any St. Louis encephalitis, and we've only had one or two cases of imported Zika. Now that we have the Aedes aegypti mosquito that can carry Zika and other diseases, we will keep monitoring that. It is now going to be a lifetime inhabitant here, which is what we projected several years ago when I started to build up the vector control program. So we have been fortunate. Northern Nevada hasn't been so fortunate. They've had a number of West Nile virus cases and some other cases as well. But that's due to the flooding and the hordes and hordes of mosquitoes. We have been on top, not that they haven't, we have been on top of where we find disease-carrying mosquitoes and spraying or larvaciding those areas to prevent other cases of disease. Jackie, did you want to add anything more? Is that okay?
Our jurisdiction meeting.
Your name?
Jackie Rezitar, Director of Environment Health. Since we've had a very robust involvement with the community, we're going to continue with a jurisdictional meeting on Wednesday. So we're going to bring them back together and look at developing an interagency policy, not a policy, but an MOU or an outline of what services we can and what they'll be able to deliver as well to meet the needs of the community.
So an example is we will mitigate pools that have disease, but we don't have the resources unless the legislature determines in its wisdom, hint, hint, hint to you all, to give us those resources. We don't have the resources to just mitigate mosquitoes because they're a nuisance. So we don't do that. If there's a jurisdiction who would like us to, then we'll have to look at some kind of a reimbursement for those services. Whereas if there's disease involved, that is our job. Our job is to mitigate disease. Am I incorrect?
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, right now, it's still a process that it's the local jurisdictions that are getting rid of green pools and any other standing water sources. It's not the district per se that takes that role.
Right, but we do help the community with ideas and suggestions on how and where they need to clean up to reduce the mosquito populations. So the effort is just really tight-knit right now. Very impressive what we've done over the last 3 years.
The cities and the county, in other words, are on board with us so far. Good. Thank you. And then finally, the presentation I inadvertently forgot about. Dr. Bleek is in the background here, and I'll invite him up to talk about our new pharmacy and the kinds of things that he's working on.
Todd Bleek, I'm the pharmacist here at the district. Thank you for having me to discuss the progress of pharmacy services here. I want to review the integration of pharmacy services into the district, as well as the timeline of events so far, and our activities that we've participated in to date, the future services that we're planning, and our strategic fit into the district's strategic plan. Integration, pharmacy services is here to support the clinical services of the district, and we've began integrating primarily by capturing prescriptions that district providers are writing. Those prescriptions have, up until we had pharmacy services, have been sent out to other pharmacies, maximizing the benefits of the 340B program. This is a drug discount program. It's a federal program that the district qualifies for, that allows us to purchase medications at a discount and use those savings to expand and to support other services that we provide. And then transferring the clinic dispensing and inventory of medications to the pharmacy. Implementing medication billing for medications for patients that have insurance. And then we're also part of packaging and storing a strategic stockpile that public health preparedness has a grant for that allows that is available here and distributed through the district to first responders in the event of a biological threat. Pharmacy services started as a grant-funded project through Ryan White back in July of last year. I started in October. We had the pharmacy licensed in March. That grant that originally funded much of the startup costs and most of the operational costs expired in March and was not renewed. That was unexpected because it was a five-year grant with annual renewals. And they ran out of resources for that grant, and so that was not renewed. We were in May and June partially funded for personnel under a public health preparedness grant to provide those packaging and distribution of those medications for those first responders in the event of a biological attack. We opened the pharmacy in May. And in starting in July, that's when we started the transfer of medication inventory and dispensing from the clinics to the pharmacy, starting with the sexual health clinic. And we're continuing that process in other areas in the district. Through September, the pharmacies filled 130 prescriptions. We've billed almost $250,000 to insurance for those medications at a cost basis of about $167,000. We've obtained medication funding assistance for 36 patients. We've also processed insurance prior authorizations on behalf of patients for 15 of those. We've referred another 15 out to community partners for medication-related services that we could not provide here. We've also had 138 pharmacist encounters with patients in the clinic, and that includes counseling patients on new medication starts, adherence assessments, drug interaction screens, and medication therapy management for patients that have multiple chronic conditions and are on multiple medications. And for that stockpile, we packaged 6,740 antibiotic courses for the first responders thus far.
So quick question, can
Yes, ma'am.
So it was 130 prescriptions at the cost of $166,000?
Correct.
So that's like 1,283. What kind of prescriptions are these?
These are primarily prescriptions, HIV-related medicines.
Okay.
Yes, so that's been our focus.
And so the what was billed and then the actual cost, the difference between those, is that net revenue that you make?
Well, we call that gross margin.
Okay.
It's not net margin, but it's gross margin.
Okay. I'm not sure that we'll receive all of that.
No, I understand
just
how that
with,
works. Trust
you,
me.
You know, but, yeah.
A large part of it we will. So so that's before all other costs. That's just our cost of medications.
Okay, I'm with you. Thank you.
Are you billing third parties for the counseling?
We're in the process of doing that. So the question from Dr. Osgood is regarding my interaction with patients, my visits with patients in the clinic, and are we billing for those things, which at this point we are not. I am funded for those visits. I'm funded under a grant currently, but that grant, that Ryan White grant, is payer of what's known as a payer of last resort. So if the patient does not have insurance, the grant will pay. So in the case where we have insured patients, we're working on getting myself credentialed in order to bill for those services, but we are currently not. Future services and projects, we applied for and learned last week that we were awarded a supplemental Ryan White grant similar to our previous grant that will partially fund pharmacy operations going forward, approximately 60% of what we're doing for the care of HIV patients. Also, we've started an HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis service in the sexual health clinic. And this involves counseling, monitoring, and medication to prevent acquisition of HIV. What we've done previously is we've patients that have sought this out through the sexual health clinic, we've had to refer out to other providers. But now we can provide that service here. Also, patients that may, or people that may have been exposed to HIV, we're working on developing a protocol to be able to treat those patients and give them what's known as post-exposure prophylaxis. So when patients are, or when people are exposed or may have been exposed, we have a window of time where we can provide medications for them that can prevent the acquisition or transmission of the virus. And currently what we do is, in patients that come to the clinic that way, is we refer them either to an urgent care or an emergency room because we do have a limited window to get that medication on board for it to be effective. We're in discussions with the Huntridge Clinic to be a referral pharmacy for their HIV patients, medications, and their pre-exposure prophylaxis clients to obtain their medications through our pharmacy. And also, as was mentioned earlier, we're working with Public Health Preparedness and as well as John Hammond to purchase and assemble the kits for the opiate overdose and Narcan medication for law enforcement. Where pharmacy fits into the strategic plan of the district is in three main areas. Goal one is strengthen financial sustainability. As we bill for medications and we better utilize the 340B program, we can cover the services that we provide in addition to generating additional revenue that can be utilized by the district to expand their services. And then providing services to community partners is also another source of revenue, such as what we're discussing with the Huntridge Clinic. Goal two, increasing staff capacity and workforce development. Providing education, we provide education to the clinical staff and training to them as well, specifically medication use. And then we're also a preceptor for multiple different schools for healthcare students, for nursing, pharmacy, medical students that we provide education for as part of their rotations here. And then the last goal, increasing capacity for information management and technology. In addition to the billing and clinical functions of the pharmacy system software, it also has a more robust inventory control and tracking system than what the district currently uses. And with that, we can better track inventory and better utilize those resources. Also, as the district implements the electronic health record, the pharmacy system will interface with that to allow communication between the two systems for patient data, billing data, and allow prescription transmissions back and forth between the clinics and the pharmacy. And so we're excited for this opportunity to be part of this plan and help expand the services here. Are there any questions I can answer for you now?
It seems like HIV is maybe holding steady as far as incidence in the community, but the syphilis incidence is increasing. Is the pharmacy intervening with any of that effort?
Not directly. But it is something that's on our radar because we've seen a plateau or a leveling out and some decline in the rate of HIV transmissions, new HIV infections, but as you mentioned, several other sexually transmitted diseases are going up quite a bit. And so our concern is that we will start to see a climb in the HIV incidence as well. So we're working with sexual health to actually help them with their options to prevent and treat the other sexual transmitted diseases.
The point is that if you get syphilis, you're doing the exact same things to get HIV or chlamydia or gonorrhea, and so that's where we need to work. But this national incidence increase in all of the sexually transmitted diseases. So we're not alone. The big cities aren't alone. It occurs in rural areas or smaller cities as well. And we've tried to get ahead of that by adding 6 new disease investigators over the last year and a half or so into our group to try to find people, interview them, find their partners. And we do, we have implemented for years now, I believe, the partner treatment protocol that the state allows, meaning that if one person comes into us with gonorrhea, we can provide a prescription to go home with that person to give to his or her partners. And that's been a standard in the United States for, I don't even know how many years now, but for many years, and it is legal here in our state as well.
Any other comments, questions? All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Anything else, Dr. Iser, that you want to bring forward?
No, sir, thank you.
All right, then, we'll go to the last public comment, and anybody wishing to speak on any item, whether it was on the agenda or not, is welcome to do so.
I have a comment, or I'd like to say something if I could. Dr. Iser, who is in charge of the health district website?
Well, Jennifer Sizemore, who's our PIO, is in, her group is in charge of it. We have both an intranet and an internet, and we are upgrading both of those as we speak. We're putting a lot of effort into doing that. I don't think Jason is here and Andy's not here, but we're in the process of upgrading those right now and getting them more up to date, if that's your comment or question.
Yeah, well, I was looking at the Board of Health members that has been updated to reflect its current membership. And ours, on the other hand,
has not
reflect that.
We will make sure that that gets done. I'm going to talk to Jennifer about getting out some sort of a listing for the PBS programs, and I'll ask her to do this too.
Yeah, because our chairman here, he's not even on here. I don't know what happened. Or
he's been on here since before the rest of you were. But that's good. Thank you.
I'm talking on the website.
Yeah, no, I understand that. We'll make sure that that's updated. Well, thank you for pointing that out. Tim is a Mr. Jones is a humble man, and he might not have pointed that out himself to us. And
I looked at the members for quite a while, but I do know that in some time in the past I was listed there. So
yeah. Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. We'll do that.
All right. Thanks, and I'll take a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
All in favor, aye?
That's my job.
All right. We are adjourned.
So on the boards in which I serve,